This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A week from today, we'll know what the new Congress will look like. Right now, there are many races for House and Senate seats that are too close to call, more close races than there have been in decades. Republicans hope to win the 40 more seats they would need to control the House and the 7 more to control the Senate. My guest, Steve Roberts, is following the elections for U.S. News and World Report, where he's a senior writer. He's also a panelist on Washington Week in Review. One theme that has emerged from this midterm election is that American voters are angry. In the current edition of U.S. News and World Report, Roberts investigates why. He's come up with 3 main reasons. Americans are squeezed financially. They're spending so much time eking out a living, there's not enough time to take care of their families. And they're worried about crime. I asked Roberts how this anger may be reflected in how America votes.
Really, when you sit around the kitchen tables of America these days and you say, what are you angry about? The first thing is not Washington or politicians. But they think that politicians are not understanding their problems and not listening to their problems and not helping them deal with their problems. In fact, they often think that politicians and government in general are making matters worse rather than better. Now, I'll give you a very graphic example. I talked to a woman in Youngstown who told me that this is a single mother of 4. And her kids came home from school with a little card given to them by the school system, which said that if your parents try to discipline you, you can call the child abuse hotline and report your own parents. Now, is child abuse a real problem? Yes, it is. Are there a couple of children in the Youngstown school systems who really might be saved from abuse by having some telephone number to call? Yes. But for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parents in Youngstown, this is meddling in their family life, and this is the schools making their attempts to discipline their kids harder, not easier. And that symbolizes what they feel about government, and that's why you have a sense of anti-incumbency, anti-politician, anti-Washington, because people feel that Washington is simply out of touch with the lives that they're living.
Who do you think is going to stand a better chance of winning because of this popular anger, and who stands a better chance of losing because of it?
Well, 2 things are true. One is that in the last few weeks, a number of incumbents are doing somewhat better than they were a month ago. This is a natural pattern in many elections, many election seasons, because we focused for a long time, Terry, on the disadvantages of incumbency and a lot of what I've just been talking about, the voter anger focused on these institutions. When they come down to judging their individual member of Congress against his or her opponent, the dynamic changes. It becomes a real choice between 2 real people and not some abstract expression of dissatisfaction. And many incumbents have long records of service to their district and their state, and that's kicking in. It's also incumbents always have a lot more money than their challengers. I think that one of the biggest untold stories of 1994, Terry, is in fact there are a number of Republican governors of big states who are cruising to re-election with virtually no opposition. And we never hear about them because they're doing so well and there's no controversy and no contest. But if you look at William Weld in Massachusetts and John Engler in Michigan and Edgar in Illinois and Thompson in Wisconsin and George Voinovich in Ohio, this is one of the most important stories of 94. And the reason why these governors are doing so well is because they hit the middle ground. In some ways, they are closer to being new Democrats than Bill Clinton has been as president. They are hitting a middle ground between the extremes on both sides, the liberal Democrats who have a big government program for everything, and the extreme conservatives who say, you know, close down the government and go home. The American people do not want either extreme. What they want is sensible, sensitive, efficient, common sense government that does understand their problems and deals with them in an efficient way and doesn't cost them an arm and a leg in taxes. And these Republican governors, I think, come closest to the balance point that Americans are looking for. And I can tell you, I've talked to a lot of Republicans who say that the party should be looking to these governors as laboratories and as role models for where the Republican Party should be going in the next 2 years and the kind of candidate they should nominate in 96 and the kind of platform they should be running on.
I wonder if you see that trend as relating to another very small trend in this election, and that is that some moderate Republicans have disavowed more conservative ones. In New York, the mayor of New York City, Rudolph Giuliani, has endorsed the Democrat. He's endorsed Mario Cuomo and disavowed Pataki, who's running against Cuomo for governor. In Pennsylvania, the widow of Senator Hines has disavowed Rick Santorum, the Republican challenger to Harris Wofford in the Senate, and she's called Santorum a Forrest Gump with attitude.
This is very much part of the same phenomenon. You can add Mayor Reardon of Los Angeles, who has endorsed Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat, for re-election in California, a former Governor Elmer Anderson, who is a Republican, who has endorsed the Democrat in the Senate race in Minnesota. And what these moderate Republicans are saying is that if the Republican Party is pulled too far to the right, and if their attitude is simply to obstruct, simply to oppose, simply to throw grenades, that the future of the Republican Party is not very bright. And they look at someone like Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, and Giuliani says, look, I got to run a city here. I can't afford to just go up on Capitol Hill and make speeches. I've got to look to the best interests of my city and the best interests of my party, and that's going to be served by a Democrat who cares about the city and not by someone like Pataki, who is a very conservative right-winger who is also the creature of Senator D'Amato, who is one of the chief bomb throwers among the Republicans on Capitol Hill. It's very much a part of the same phenomenon. And, you know, the Republican Party is going to do very, very well in these elections. But one of the reasons is they're rather unified around the notion of opposing Bill Clinton. Very close to the surface, there are some very important splits in the Republican Party between this sort of moderate, pragmatic approach to government, problem-solving approach to government, set against some of the leaders on Capitol Hill, Newt Gingrich being the major example, whose whole role in life is simply to tear things down and be critical, and are not builders but destroyers. And that basic fault line is going to reemerge after this election.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the elections with Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Well, Newt Gingrich might become the Speaker of the House. He came up with something called the Contract with America, which has been signed by more than 300 candidates, Republican candidates, for the House. What is the agenda of that, and what direction do you see that leading the Republican Party in?
Well, the Contract for America was very carefully designed and very shrewdly drawn based on some very extensive polling that the Republicans did. In fact, you notice the Contract for America doesn't include the word Republican anywhere in it. That's because Republican didn't poll very well, and so they didn't include it. This is very much a made-for-TV political gimmick, but the fact is that the Democrats think, and I think the Democrats are in some ways overestimating the mistake. They seem gleeful over this, and they're running very hard against the contract because they think people remember the 80s with disdain. I think people remember the 80s fairly well. They liked Ronald Reagan. And even though Ronald Reagan's economic policies did certainly add to a much bigger deficit, I don't think the Democrats are necessarily going to prosper by saying the Republicans want to take us back to the 1980s. I think that was a time when people were pretty positive about government and about their leadership. But there's no doubt that the contract continues an important element of Reaganism, and that is to simply choke off the sources of revenue for the federal government. When you talk about the balanced budget amendment, when you talk about the line item veto, when you talk about a number of other elements in this package, it's all designed to throttle the government, to shrink the government. And they've been rather successful in doing that. We're still dealing with the after effects, for instance, of the Reagan tax cut, which severely restricted the income flow to the federal government and is part of the reason why we have such big deficits. But it's also part of the reason why there has been much more discipline over federal spending.
You were talking before about the split between a very conservative and more moderate Republicans within the party.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that incoming Republicans are more likely to be conservative than outgoing Republicans?
Yes in the House, no in the Senate. It's interesting. The House, they've recruited a lot of very conservative people. House districts are a lot smaller. You can appeal to much more narrow constituencies. A lot of the energy in the Republican Party in recent years has come from the more conservative wing of the party. The religious right has been very active in Republican Party politics, has provided a lot of energy, a lot of workers, a lot of money to the party. But when you run statewide, particularly in larger states, you can't be so narrow. You have to be somewhat broader in your appeal, somewhat more open to other ideas, because by definition, you're heading up a coalition. And I think that in the House, the Republican Party is likely to be very, very conservative. Its leadership is very hard right and very confrontational in its style. But I think in the Senate, it'll be different. I think that you will have a stronger representation from the more moderate wing of the Republican Party. You have a number of Republicans who are openly willing to discuss cooperation with the Democrats, senators like Specter of Pennsylvania, Kassebaum of Kansas. The new senator from Maine is likely to be Olympia Snowe, who was a very progressive Republican when she was in the House. The other senator from Maine, Bill Cohn, is in the same mold. So you can count 6, 8, 10 Republicans who are there mainly for the purpose of passing legislation and dealing with problems and not just making speeches. And so I think the prospects for bipartisan cooperation in the Senate are reasonably good, in the House, pretty dismal.
If the Republicans win a majority in the House, then Newt Gingrich would become the House Speaker. He drafted the Contract with America. Early on, when he got voted into Congress, he founded the Conservative Opportunity Society. What direction do you see him leading the Republican Party in?
Well, Newt Gingrich is an extremely shrewd and extremely tenacious political operative. Democrats have underestimated him very often. One of the things that Newt Gingrich has been an absolute master at is understanding the nature of television and understanding that television is incapable of covering legislation in any real depth, and that they what television focuses on when they cover Congress are personalities and scandals and controversies, but not on legislation in any great depth. And he's been very successful at helping to create the negative mood in the country about Congress. Fact is, he has been probably Congress's most efficient opponent. And so if he were then to become Speaker of the House, it would be a very interesting and odd change where he actually would be responsible for moving legislation. And one of the open questions is whether he is capable of moving from being a bomb thrower on the outside. You know, it's much easier to throw grenades than it is to catch them. And it's an open question as to how he would evolve. He is very political. He views everything through the lens of how to enhance Republican prospects. And some of the frustration has been justified. The Republicans have been out of power for 40 years in the House. The Democrats have treated them with insistent disdain. They use the rules to repress the Republican ability to offer amendments. They cut back on their staffs. The Democrats might hate Newt Gingrich, but they've had a large role in helping to create him, because they've helped create the discontent and the frustration in Republican ranks that have led Republicans to choose a leader of this stripe. And it's a very interesting question as to whether he can now turn into a legislator with a real program, or whether he will just continue to play politics with everything. I think it's that question is yet to be answered.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the elections with Steve Roberts, senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. I remember toward the end of George Bush's presidency, we had a talk about gridlock in mm-hmm. Congress. And I wonder how you think the gridlock that President Clinton has faced compares to the gridlock that President Bush faced.
Well, I think Bill Clinton has made some very basic mistakes in dealing with the Congress. I think that he failed to read the polls and the election results very well. He acted as if he had gotten 53 or even 63% of the vote instead of 43% of the vote. I think that he tried too often to push bills through with just Democratic votes. George Bush, of course, never had that luxury. During his 4 years in Congress, the Democrats controlled the Congress, and his gridlock was a more familiar one, where he had to use his veto over 30 times simply to stop a Democratic legislative initiatives. With a Democratic president and a Democratic control of the Congress, it was more a question of Clinton putting up bills and being too liberal for the mainstream of his party. And I think that he made two huge mistakes. One was not reaching across the aisle often enough and early enough to woo progressive Republicans to his side. Probably his single most significant legislative victory of 2 years, which was the passage of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was done with heavy Republican support. I think that was part of a mindset. He ran as a new Democrat. He talked about being bipartisan. He talked about bringing Republicans into the White House, but he never really acted that way. I think that he helped bring a lot of the gridlock on himself by misreading where the balance point in American politics was. For him to come in with the kind of health care program, which just groaned and moaned under bureaucratic notions and proposals, and also that would have cost a great deal of money in taxes that Americans were not willing to pay.
You know, we started our conversation with you talking about the anger of so many American voters are feeling now and how that might affect the election next week. And I wonder if you think that anger is giving away to cynicism. And if you think that has a chance of lifting in the near future, or if you think that anger and cynicism is something we're going to be stuck with for a really long time when it comes to American politics.
That's a very good question. The anger, in many ways, is justified. The cynicism, in many ways, is manufactured and exploited and used by people who, for their own political views. A friend of mine, Tom Mann, here in Washington, is a political scientist, describes the cynicism industry. And I think it's a good description. The anger is real. People are falling behind economically. 70% or 60% of the American public says in our polls at U.S. News that the American dream is impossible to achieve. The same number think that the economy is not in recovery, even though every economic indicator says that it is. So the concerns are real. People feel that they're falling behind. They're not living as well as their parents. They don't have time for their families. Their kids are being subjected to all these cultural influences that they don't agree with. There's a sense of stress and guilt and lack of control that is tangible. It just pops out at you every time you sit around a kitchen table or a cafe table in communities across this country. But that very real anger has been exploited by a whole network of people, some of them politicians themselves. There are so many politicians in both parties who are running against the very institution that they want to serve in. They're trashing Congress as they run against it. That helps create a cynicism about our leadership. Talk radio, that is part of the picture, where everything is angry, everything is critical, everything is, every time you talk about a member of Congress, you talk about him as a corrupt scoundrel. That's an inaccurate and unfair picture, but that's the way it's done. And I must say, my own profession of journalism is part of this conspiracy. We are part of this cynicism industry. We see Congress in an almost totally negative light, in part because Congress sees itself in a negative light. And all of that combined has created a very deep cynicism. People really don't trust their leaders anymore. And I worry about that because I think it's essential to a healthy democracy to have some measure of trust and confidence. And In the 60s, if you asked Americans in a poll, do you trust government to do the right thing most of the time? About 70% would say yes. Today, you ask people that question, only about 20% say yes. And that's an enormous and unhealthy change. We should hold leaders to a high standard. We as journalists have to be very tough on them. But we are edging over from justifiable skepticism to a kind of a savage cynicism. And we're all part of it. And we all have to take some of the blame. And I think it's going to be hard to reverse. And the only way you can reverse it is by Congress listening better, by the leadership listening better, by doing the things people really care about and trying to make a difference in their real lives. And then you can start to reverse that. But that's very difficult.
Steve Roberts, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Steve Roberts is senior writer with U.S. News and World Report and a panelist on Washington Week in Review. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.